I have no problem with our fans. Our fans are great. I got a problem with our scoreboard operator. I got to have a little talk with him. I'm not sure what he's doing. He's playing music and showing players dancing and getting the crowd fired up when we have the ball. I don't think we should be doing that. I don't think we should be showing, their quarterback on the sideline. I thought that was kind of disrespectful. So our fans are great. Our fans are loud. But the scoreboard operators wasn't his best night.
Wow. When I first heard that, I thought, here's Peyton Manning with the deadpan SNL United Way spoof, not really serious, because he can pull that off. And that's what it seemed like. I thought he was making some sort of a joke. The guy's serious. I mean, stone cold killer. The scoreboard operator needs to step his game up, and I'm going to call him out publicly. I'm not going to deal with this privately. I am going to call him out publicly. And it makes you wonder, implicitly, he's also calling out anyone else who's in the position of managing the scoreboard operator. And we wonder what Peyton Manning's going to do when he stops playing. I think you give him the keys to a franchise, because this is Peyton Manning. While he's in the midst of a game, he's in position to notice what's wrong, what's not wrong, what's right, what's not right with the scoreboard operation. Micromanager, but in a good way. And the kind of guy who isn't afraid to get in your face and tell you you're not getting it done. And you need to have a little bit of that quality. This whole Russell Wilson thing in Seattle, the idea that, as suggested by Mike Freeman of Bleacher Report, that in some way Russell Wilson's not black enough, most people don't even know what that means. Look, here's what I think the problem is in Seattle. For whatever reason, Russell Wilson isn't coming across the way Peyton Manning does. He isn't that kind of leader that is going to hold people accountable. It all seems packaged and programmed and predetermined. Russell Wilson seems to be playing the role that he thinks he should be playing, not the natural, authentic, organic leader. When you are doing it naturally and authentically, people see it. And I think that may be the ultimate problem, the heart of the problem in Seattle. This wasn't supposed to be about the Seahawks, but as I think about it, Peyton Manning is a natural, authentic, organic leader, and he's not afraid to tell you what you need to hear. I think Russell Wilson maybe spends too much time telling people what he thinks they want to hear. That may be the area where Russell Wilson needs to develop and grow the most in order to avoid the resentment that he's apparently experiencing. But Peyton Manning continues every touchdown pass to break his own record. Are they sending the balls to Canton in a shopping bag? They should be, because every additional touchdown pass pushes the bar higher. How high will it go? Who knows at this point? But here's where I'm most impressed with Peyton Manning. He is in that sweet spot where he understands the game well enough to be a coach, and he's on the field, and he still has enough physical skills to play, and he knows what he can't do, and he doesn't do the things he can't do. That's a lesson to anybody in any walk of life. Know what you can't do and don't do it. Know what you can do and do that. A couple of years ago, early in the season, we saw Peyton Manning throwing some ugly, fluttery ducks down the field. They were intercepted. Oh, woe is Peyton. It's over. He's not going to get his groove back. Well, no, Peyton was just testing the limits of what he can do. He figured out that line between what he can do, what he can't do, and he stays on the right side of what he can do. That's why, as his physical skills inevitably deteriorate, he won't do the things that he can't do. He'll operate within the universe of what he physically can accomplish, all the while his brain getting better every year with more experience, more understanding, meticulous planning, incredible recollection. He knows what he's seeing on the field. He knows how to adjust to it. And I think this guy could play deep into his 40s if he wants to, because he understands exactly how to get the job done. Now, one person he probably wouldn't be calling out publicly based upon the outcome of the play, referee Terry McCauley, that inexplicable ruling overturning what would have been a fumble by the Broncos on a kickoff return after the Chargers had tied the game at 7. Huge swing, because the Broncos went right down the field and took a 14-7 lead. And here's what we need to remember, because Dean Blandino, the VP of officiating, actually took to Twitter to defend the decision. But here's what we have to remember. The call on the field is entitled to a very high degree of deference. In order to overcome the call on the field, the evidence must be indisputable that the call was wrong. The call on the field was that Andre Caldwell fumbled the football. The call on the field was that the Chargers recovered the football. There must be indisputable visual evidence that Caldwell was not losing possession of the ball before his forearm struck the ground. I know McCauley said elbow. Any part of your body other than your hand and foot, if it hits the ground, you're down if there's contact involved, and clearly contact was involved. So the ball is moving before the forearm hits the ground. I've watched it 50 times. The ball is moving. So is that indisputable visual evidence that the call on the field was wrong? It's not, because the ball is moving. What happened here is McCauley, with the real-time assistance of Blandino, supplied their own judgment for the judgment that was made in real time. And to be sure, it's a close call. But when it's a close call, the call on the field should not be overturned. It's that simple. And the whole idea of moving the replay function to New York, or at least giving Blandino a direct voice in the process, was to ensure that the right standard gets applied. Because all too often, referees weren't going to that little booth and making a decision based on the controlling standard of indisputable visual evidence. They were making a fresh decision. They were making the decision with no deference given to the ruling on the field. That's what went wrong last night. And the NFL is going to defend it. I understand that. And the employees of the NFL are going to defend it. I understand that. To their credit, CBS, which has a fairly close relationship with the NFL by virtue of the Thursday night package that ended last night, although CBS will continue to produce the NFL Network-only games, they were willing to come out and say, it's a bad call. And it was a bad call. Not because of the actual analysis of the image, but because of the ruling on the field. The review did not give the ruling on the field the credence, the deference that it deserves. And if it had gone the other way, if the ruling on the field had been no fumble, I don't think there's indisputable visual evidence to overturn that ruling. That's the key. And we lose sight of that too often. And the NFL believed the referees lost sufficient sight of that to take the replay function to New York City. Well, if that was the goal, last night's call was an example that it doesn't work. Now, we don't know what the goal is in New York City / New Jersey on Sunday for the use of Percy Harvin by the New York Jets against the Buffalo Bills. But one thing I've noticed over the years, when a receiver, a veteran receiver, joins a new team, either at the beginning of the season or during the season, you can't expect a whole lot that year. There have been exceptions, but for the most part, you can't expect that receiver to come in and make a big impact. He doesn't know the personnel, doesn't know the offense, et cetera, et cetera. Percy Harvin could be the exception if they use him the right way. Because you don't need to have a thorough understanding of the offense, a thorough understanding of how Geno Smith throws the ball, how he likes the receivers to come out of the breaks, how the receivers and the quarterback work together with hand signals and sight adjustments and go in instead of out and run this route instead of that route. You don't need that. All you got to do is get the ball in the guy's hands. Kickoff returns, get the ball in his hands. Now you got the ball at the 50 instead of the 30. Give him a handoff on that jet sweep. Fake the handoff on the jet sweep. Send him deep. The go route, the nine route, that opens everything up because you're going to have two guys go with Percy Harvin. And if you don't, throw it over the top. How hard is it to run straight down the field and look back for the football? There are ways you can use Percy Harvin. Bubble screen, get it in his hands, get it in his hands, get it in his hands. Let him then work based on instinct. Then you don't have to know the playbook. Then it's just football. Get the ball in his hands and let him do his thing. And if the Jets do that enough times, that's enough of a difference to overcome a 4-3 Bills team that really doesn't seem as good as 4-3 would suggest, and the Jets don't seem as bad as 1-6 would suggest. And this is one of those correction games, and Harvin, I think, is going to help make that difference for the New York Jets. When we come back, another team desperately in need of a correction game, the New Orleans Saints. They host the Packers on Sunday night on NBC. We'll talk to Jeff Duncan and the New Orleans Times-Picayune about what's wrong with the Saints. Should they be panicking? Should the fans be panicking? There's still 6 home games left for the Saints. They've won both of them. Do they have a chance to beat the Packers on Sunday night and make a run at a division that no one seems to want to win? And then we'll see who seems to want to ask questions, because it's PFT Planet Day. We've got a stack of Twitter questions that I haven't looked at yet. Probably should. We'll open the phone lines. I never look at those in advance, obviously, unless it's a plant. Would we ever admit that? Maybe we would. Maybe we have. I can't recall. That's my official answer. My official position also is, stick around. We'll be right back after this. This is PFT Live. Sunday night on NBC, it's the Saints and the Packers. And yes, I know, the Saints are 2-4. But they're 13-0 in their last 13 primetime home games, and the Packers roll into town with a four-game winning streak. And the last two times these teams have played, they've been pretty good games. So here's hoping, fingers crossed, for a close game on Sunday night. And joining us now to help us get ready for that game and give us an idea of where the Saints really are six games into the season, our good pal Jeff Duncan of the New Orleans Times Picayune. Jeff, welcome to the program. And should Saints fans generally be concerned about this team six games in?
Well, obviously the record is nowhere near what anybody expected, including the Saints, Mike. But the fact is three of their four losses have come by a total of 6 points on the road. So this team has been competitive. They just have not figured out a way to finish out some of these games. As you know, most of these games in the NFL come down to a handful of plays, often in the two-minute drive at the end. And the Saints have lost that mojo in that area. And that's a little disconcerting when you have Drew Brees and such a veteran offense. But they do feel like that the division is so down this year that maybe 7-9, 8-8 could win it. So they feel like they've still got a lot to play for.
Yeah, and that would be the ultimate irony, too, if they'd win that division at 8-8 or 7-9, then a team like the Seahawks has to come in with a better record, and that home field advantage gives the Saints the edge, and they win the game. That would be the perfect bookend to what happened 4 years ago when the Saints had to go to Seattle. But for the Saints, I mean, defensively, that seems to have been a bigger problem. I know turnovers have been a problem on offense, but why is the defense so much worse than it was last season?
You know, the back end got overhauled in the offseason. Jabari Greer, Roman Harper, Malcolm Jenkins did not come back for different reasons. And I think the Saints misjudged, frankly. They got a bad break with Jairus Byrd, their big free agent acquisition. Obviously, they didn't get much out of him before he was injured. And they misjudged the other cornerback spot. They banked on Champ Bailey getting a year out of him, sort of a Darren Sharper-type experiment. It didn't work out. And Patrick Robinson has not come back from his knee injury, lost his confidence, and they really have no other option back there. So they're hurting on the back end. And the pass rush has been a big disappointment. Everybody thought Cam Jordan and Junior Gallette were ready to take the next step as bookend ends, and they have not provided the pass rush. And really, frankly, Mike, it's made me think maybe that last year was almost an outlier, and this is the real Saints defense.
How much of this falls on Rob Ryan, though, not self-scouting, not doing what he had to do to go back and look and see whatever clues, tips, tendencies were in the approach last year to try to confuse offenses? Because to have that drop-off, I mean, there's got to be something. It tells me in the coaching there's got to be some factor there. Is there any truth to that possibility that Rob Ryan maybe didn't do enough to overhaul his schemes going into 2014?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that Rob Ryan has to bear some of this burden. They've got enough talent over there that they would play better than they're playing so far. There's been a lot of communication breakdowns, a lot of the same things we heard in the scouting report on Rob Ryan when he came to New Orleans a year ago from Cleveland, from Dallas, that is, he got too infatuated with bells and whistles, made things too complicated. And we've seen that play out on the field with some breakdowns and assignments and some undisciplined play in tackling. So I don't think there's any doubt that coaching's played into this, but it's certainly not the only reason that they've struggled. They've really not been good in any phase, coaching, playing, fundamentals. They just haven't played very well in any phase. So I think that is not going to get any better anytime soon. I think the Saints' hopes are going to rest with getting their offense fixed and trying to outscore people, and that starts Sunday night.
Yeah, one of the headlines that was generated this week as it relates to the defense is this Operation Feed Drew. Maybe a little hokey, maybe not the kind of thing that will motivate NFL players, but give us an idea of what the defense is getting at with this.
Well, they've got to get more short field for Drew Brees to work with. They've got to start creating turnovers. It's been well documented ever since I've been here, just about, Mike, that this team, other than the Super Bowl year, has struggled to force turnovers, and the numbers this year are pretty staggering. How many times Drew Brees and that offense are being forced to go 80 yards to score, and they want to feed Brees the ball on the short side of the field and try and get leads. I mean, Sean Payton's whole MO since he's been here has been seize a quick lead with that offense, jump on teams early, and make the other team one-dimensional, and all of a sudden your defense plays a lot better when you're up 14 points. They haven't been able to do that. They've been playing from behind a lot, and it really hurts their play-action passing game, almost all phases of this complementary game that Sean Payton wants to employ.
And Jeff, they had a very comfortable lead against the Detroit Lions on Sunday, and it all fell apart. The long touchdown catch and run by Golden Tate, the interception from Drew Brees. How much of that lingers? Because it can't be easy to turn the page on something like that and get ready to play a team like the Packers.
Well, that was a gut punch, no question. That was a game that they had in their grasp. They did everything right for 55 minutes and squandered it. And even though they had had all those things go against them, the things you mentioned, the long pass, the interception by Brees, they still had the ball, Mike, with a minute 50 or so, one timeout, and Drew Brees under center. In the past, 2011, 2009, these great state teams we've covered here, they would have driven down and gotten a field, gotten out of there with a win. This team isn't good enough to overcome those things. They're just not as talented across the board. And for whatever reason, I think it's starting to get in their head. There's a little bit of a lack of confidence on the road, especially, that they can close out these games. I think we saw it play out last weekend.
How does the offensive line play into that? Because I watched the end of that game, and it just seemed like Drew wasn't getting an opportunity to find anybody.
Yeah, that's a great observation. At the end, they could not block the Lions, and the Lions were only using the four-man rush. And I think that's a legitimate observation. This line is playing, I think, with some older players. I mean, Zach Strieff, Jari Evans have been here now since 2006. Ben Grubbs is 30 years old, and when John Goodwin was starting, he's another player that's up around 30. And, you know, there's a theory that John Clayton has used before that I think is relevant, and that's when your five starting linemen, their ages add up to 100.
And did we lose Jeff?
I think that's definitely happened here.
Yeah, and that doesn't get enough credit when an offense goes well, and it doesn't get enough blame when an offense goes poorly. Regardless of how the offensive line does this week, tight end Jimmy Graham, a non-factor last week, a decoy it appeared. What do we expect from Graham this week? I assume he'll play. No sign he aggravated the injury, but will he really be involved in the game plan?
You know, I expect him to be a very similar game plan. He was basically operating with one arm last week. I'm not sure how effective that was. You know, Sean Payton is a big believer in mind games, and I think he wanted to use Jimmy Graham to make them prepare for him. And I'm sure that had some effect on the game plan of Detroit, but I thought it was almost a waste of time because Graham played 30 snaps and wasn't targeted at all. And Detroit's defensive players came out and said he was not a factor. We didn't even worry about him. So I'm not sure how effective he's going to be this week. I think that injury is probably another week away from him becoming a factor in the passing game. And they're going to need everybody, Mike. I mean, this Green Bay team is operating, firing on all cylinders right now. They're deep at the receiving core, and they're going to get, I would imagine, scoring in the 30s. The Saints are going to have to score points, and I'm not sure they can do that without a healthy Jimmy Graham.
Injury issues also apply to running back Pierre Thomas, reportedly going to miss a couple of games with a shoulder injury of his own. What do you know about whether there's a chance he plays and how much time he'll miss?
Well, I think he's going to be limited if he does play at all, and I really think that more than likely we won't see him this weekend, and that again is going to limit them as well. So, you know, I would be surprised with that kind of injury that quickly that he comes back.
Now, also at running back, Mark Ingram was gone for a few weeks with a hand injury. He's back. He's pushing toward a contract year. Do you think Ingram will be with the Saints in 2015?
I don't, you know, and I don't think it's any kind of reflection on Mark Ingram. I just think the Saints are going to be so tight against the cap, and they've got some options there with Kyrie Robinson, with Pierre Thomas, with Travaris Cadet, that they're going to have the option there, I think, to go without him, much like they did when Reggie Bush was allowed to leave. I just think that's one area that where they're blessed with some depth. But I do think Mark Ingram has a chance this year to finish this season strong. He was running very well before his injury. It was just a hand injury, so it's not going to be something that affects his running ability. And I expect him to have a big game Sunday night. They're going to need him. Green Bay's run defense is one of the weak points of that team. And if Sean Payton and Drew Brees are patient, they can find some yards on the ground.
And with Jimmy Graham injured, you need healthy and effective targets in the passing game. Brandon Cooks, rookie that's created a lot of buzz. What's been your assessment of him so far? And could he have a coming out party Sunday night against the Packers?
Yeah, he's going to need it. I mean, he has not shown up with very many explosive plays this year. I think the second snap of the season, the Saints got him the ball 35 yards downfield. We haven't seen enough of that since then, and it's not for lack of trying. They've used him in the screen game. They've used him on reverses. A lot of the same touches we saw Darren Sproles get, they're using with Brandon Cooks, but they're doing it at the receiver position, and he's going to have to be a guy that steps up. He's one of the few guys they have in the perimeter group that can get separation, that has that explosiveness to take a play of the length of the football field, and they haven't had nearly enough of those. If you had to point to one thing in this offense that's different this year than past years under Drew Brees, they're not getting those big plays like they did in the past, and that's what Brandon Cooks was drafted for. They traded up to get him because they thought he would add that element. We haven't seen it so far, and they could certainly use it Sunday.
Yeah, Jeff, 34 catches, 278 yards. That's 8.2 yards per catch. That is not indicative of a guy who's going to be making explosive plays. You'd expect that to be doubled for a guy like Cooks, and maybe we'll see if he can up that average on Sunday night. When you look at the Packers, and they're coming in with four straight wins, I believe, at 5-2, and Aaron Rodgers looking even better than he did in 2011 when he was the league MVP. What should Rob Ryan and company be trying to do? Just slow them down? Just knock them from 37 down to 30? Or just go after him and try to, do what it seems like no one can do, which is maybe hold him under 20?
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't really see any way that they can slow them down. What I think might be part of this game plan is something similar to what we saw in St. Louis the other day. You know, Sean Payton is known to pull out a trick play or two, steal a possession. It wouldn't surprise me to take the ball out of the hands of Aaron Rodgers and that offense because, frankly, Mike, their secondary, the Saints' secondary, is injury-riddled and not that talented. They're going to have a lot of trouble matching up with Aaron Rodgers and their receiving core. And I know Mike McCarthy, I covered him here. He will exploit their third and fourth options and I think can make hay. The only way I think the Saints possibly can hang in this game defensively is if they get some turnovers, maybe force some fumbles, but they haven't shown that ability to strip the ball, to populate the ball and come up with those turnovers. That's why I think we might see something a little unconventional out of Sean Payton this week. He hasn't done much of that this year, and I think he's going to have to do something like that maybe to protect his defense.
And, Jeff, it also makes sense when the Saints have the ball to do what we saw the Chargers try to do last night with the Broncos, what they did successfully last year against Denver: slow drives, chew up the clock, frustrate Aaron Rodgers, keep him on the sideline. That really doesn't seem to be the Saints' way, though. Run between the tackles, get first downs, work your way down the field. You think they could pull that off?
I think they're going to have to. I think it's really it's weird to say this, Mike, but the Saints don't want to get in a shootout with Green Bay. How many times have we ever said something like that about New Orleans with Drew Brees? But I really don't think they can get into a point-scoring fest against this offense. I do think the running game is going to be their friend. It's one of the weaknesses of Dom Capers' attack this year. And the Saints have run the ball much better this year. This is the second year in Brett Engel's zone blocking scheme. They're much more comfortable up front. And it takes a lot of the pressure off Brees. We don't see him under that duress constantly when they're just in that pass-first mode like we saw at the end of the Lions game. They're just not as adept up front at pass blocking as they were. And I think with the stable of backs they've got there, and the run blocking is improving, especially with Teron Armstead at left tackle. That's got to be the MO on Sunday night.
And when we look ahead, showdown with the Panthers in Carolina on Thursday night. Now, I don't expect any public complaints about this, but what do the Saints think about playing up until 11 o'clock or so local time on a Sunday night and then having to turn around and play on Thursday? I mean, typically you'd like to get your game done on Sunday a few hours earlier than that because you have to turn around and play on a short week. Any concerns, any complaints from the Saints quietly, privately about having to play into late Sunday night and then again on Thursday night?
Well, no one said anything out on Airline Drive, but rest assured, I'm sure privately there's no love lost, as we all know, for Park Avenue and the schedule makers and what's taking place this week. That's a tough turnaround. I mean, we saw Peyton Manning talking about it this past week, having to play a game against the 49ers and then turn around and get to San Diego, but they were able to do it all at home. The Saints now have to go on the road against their main rival. And, you know, this is one thing I will say is Sean Payton's been very good at these kind of situations. They have a veteran staff and a veteran team, guys like Drew Brees, that can handle these kind of quirks in the schedules, I think, more so than teams operating in their first year under a new coach or having a younger roster. So I do think they'll be able to handle it. Whether they're good enough to do it or not, I think, is a whole other question.
I still think the Saints can win the division. Jeff, we touched on it earlier. It doesn't seem like anybody wants to rise up and win it. The Panthers in first place at 3-3-1. Am I crazy to think the Saints can still win this thing and maybe win it easily if they can pick up a few road wins?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, they've only played two conference games, or division games so far, Mike. So they've still got both matchups left with Carolina, who I think clearly is going to be the main challenger there. I think Atlanta is in a transition phase, Tampa Bay the same way. They can sweep Carolina, and I very much expect them to be able to beat them in the Superdome. I think 8-8 will win this division. The Saints got to stay healthy. Everybody says that, but the Saints at certain positions in the secondary are very vulnerable, but they have the offensive firepower, I think, to win a bunch of these games, and most of their games the rest of the way are in the Superdome, and we know they're a much different team there. They can beat just about anybody there.
Well, great stuff, Jeff. Enjoy the game Sunday night. Thanks for some of your time. We'll talk to you again down the road.
Yeah, anytime, Mike. Take care, buddy.
There he is, Jeff Duncan, New Orleans Times-Picayune. And to kind of finish where we started, it really would be perfect and it would be fitting if the Saints end up winning that division 8-8, 7-9, and a team like the Seahawks, and specifically the Seahawks, has to come there and play in the Superdome. It would further expose how unfair it is for a team that just happens to be the best of four bad teams to get a home playoff game at a place where the home field advantage creates a true advantage and makes it difficult for anybody to come in and win, especially in a postseason setting. So it would be fair in a way because the Saints have been on the wrong side of that. But big picture, that's not the way it should be, but nobody really cares what I think. Somebody cares what I think, or you wouldn't be asking me questions. We've got some Twitter questions we're going to answer when we come back, and we'll take your phone calls. It's Friday. It's PFT Planet Day. You're not working, or maybe you are. Maybe you can just take it. Maybe you can act like it's a work call. 888-237-5269. Either way, give us a buzz. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. It's PFT Planet Time. We do it every Friday. Most Fridays. Almost every Friday. We're doing it this Friday. Let's answer your first question. It comes from at Bear Down Buck. What will be the deciding factor between the Cardinals and the Eagles? You know, I think the deciding factor is going to be that Chip Kelly has 2 weeks to get ready for the game. Chip Kelly has been great, just like his predecessor Andy Reid coming out of bye weeks, not just because he's only got 1 year in the NFL, but last year the Eagles beat the Cardinals coming out of the bye week. And at Oregon, whenever he had a bye week, Chip Kelly would come out on the other end and win, undefeated in regular season bye weeks, or at least after, always undefeated in the bye week. Undefeated also after the bye week. I think that extra time to plan, that extra time to mix things up, you've seen that team get better on the fly. It happened last year. It's happened this year. They were winning with smoke and mirrors at first, and then they just blow the Giants off the field. Eagles getting better. We forgot about them last week. I think the Cardinals are overmatched, especially against a team like the Eagles, which is going to take full advantage of that bye week to go to Arizona and win a matchup of a couple of 5-1 teams. Another Twitter question from at Matthew Nutter. Is this Brady's last season in New England? His cap number going forward makes him easily tradable a la Joe Montana. Yeah, but now, a month ago, after that loss to the Chiefs, yeah, maybe it is Brady's last year. Maybe they are going to move on to Jimmy Garoppolo, a.k.a. Prince Aladdin, which is what they call him in the locker room. They think he looks like Prince Aladdin. There he is on the right. I don't know. But Tom Brady looks like Tom Brady, and it looks like he's going to continue to be the quarterback. I think he's there for at least 3 more years because his salaries are so affordable. And I think he gets special treatment over and above the usual rip the name off the back of the jersey and assess the guy based on who he is right now. I think the Patriots are going to find a way to keep him around and put the right guys around him as long as his physical skills are there. Now, I talked earlier in the show about Peyton Manning, understanding the limits of what he can and can't do. Brady needs to be the same way, and at times I think Brady tries to do things that Tom Brady of a decade ago could do, But Tom Brady of today can't do. That's going to be a key challenge for him going forward, because when you try to do things you can't do, you start making mistakes. And maybe that's part of why he's improved this year. He's not trying to force balls that Tom Brady, circa 2014, can't force. Next up, our good friend at A Red Zone Alk. Is the reaction in the United States to the early kickoff in London between Detroit and Atlanta more important than the result on the field? No, I don't think it is. But here's the thing, and at A Red Zone Alk is a friend of ours who's over in England somewhere and asks us questions all the time, appropriate questions, questions that contain language that is fitting for this format, but I digress, as I usually do. I think the NFL here, kind of like the pizza company looking for places to stuff cheese, and this is the crust that has yet to be experimented with by the NFL, because 9:30 a.m. East Coast time, first of all, it creates a more manageable kickoff time in London. It's not an evening kickoff. It's a mid-afternoon kickoff. They're 5 or 6 hours ahead of us. But it also gives the NFL a captive audience on Sunday morning, when we otherwise would be watching pregame shows that people really don't watch much anymore on Sunday mornings, because there's so many other ways to get your information, like on the internet at profootballtalk.com. You don't need to sit there and listen to a lot of talk about things you don't care about. Because that's, I remember when I wasn't in this business and I'd watch the pregame shows, a lot of the stuff I just didn't care about. I cared about a couple of games, a couple of players, and I really didn't need to feature this and let's try to be funny with that and Rob Riggle here and Frank Kelly under there. I didn't care about any of that stuff. Not that they had it back then. But I think we'll see that people will watch this game and people won't watch the pregame shows on Sunday. And if enough people watch, I think we will see future London games have the stage to themselves on early Sunday mornings. Okay, next up, another question from at RJ Pace. Should I be scared that my Browns will give another team their first win? Yes, you should be scared. You should be afraid. You should be very afraid. The Oakland Raiders come to town 34 years after they delivered the Browns, well, the Ravens, but the Browns at the time, one of the worst postseason losses in franchise history. The Raiders come in without a single win. 0-6, second week in a row that the Browns are facing an 0-6 team. And if they lose, I mean, that's got to be something that we research here. How many times has a team lost in consecutive weeks to a team with an 0-6 record? And that very well could happen. But, you know, what we heard coming from the Browns this week, specifically running back Terrence West, is that the Jaguars wanted it more. And Denard Robinson, the Jaguars running back, was on the program yesterday talking about the home field advantage that arises when the Jaguars are doing well in a given game and the support they get and they feed off of it. And I think the Jaguars provided a little bit of a trap, a little bit of a hornet's nest for the Browns, and they didn't realize what they'd gotten themselves into. Browns are at home this weekend. The Browns are going to be smarting a little bit. They're going to be ready to show that they're still a good team, and I'd be shocked if they don't get it done. But if they fail to get it done in this spot, it could be Johnny Manziel time sooner rather than later. The Browns answer kind of by default the question of whether Brian Hoyer is going to be the quarterback for 2015, because if you lose back-to-back weeks to 0-6 teams, you're not the answer. You're not a franchise quarterback, so this is going to be a big test for Hoyer and the offense. Another question via Twitter from at Jesse Grimsley. Is there any way the Jets make a move for a cornerback, or was Percy all the help Rex is going to get? Yeah, look, I don't know who is on the block. Now, a week ago, I'd have been shocked if I knew that Percy Harvin was available. The Seahawks did a great job keeping that quiet. There's no big name out there that is definitely available that someone is shopping around at cornerback. I think the Jets are just going to have to sit tight. You don't want to start giving away too many of your draft picks. Yeah, it's only going to be a 6th-round pick, maybe a 4th-round pick if they keep Harvin on the roster, which I don't think they'll do, not at his current salary. You don't want to start giving away draft picks just in the hopes of winning a few games this year so John Idzik, the GM, doesn't get fired. I continue to be convinced that that's why this was done. All the criticism of Idzik not spending money, not giving Rex Ryan playmakers, I think this is about Idzik saving his job. And I don't see him mortgaging any more of the draft picks that he has for next year to try to save his job. Because then you'll lose your job next year because you don't have the draft picks to go out and replenish your team. But they gladly gave up that 6th-round pick because I think there was a chance Idzik wasn't going to be there next year to use that pick. And there's still a chance he won't be there next year. I assume they're going to win this week with Harvin. But how many games are they really going to win with Harvin? How much of a difference can Harvin make? And how much of a difference can one cornerback make? Well, I don't know that one's going to be available. One more question, maybe one more, maybe two more. Either way, the next one comes from at a random beast, kind of, at a random, yeah, close enough. Are the Ravens overperforming, or will they keep this level of play throughout the season? Well, look, I'm a believer in teams that get better on the fly, especially with a new offense. Gary Kubiak coming in with a different approach than what the Ravens are used to. So as you see a team win games after maybe a bit of a sluggish start, they did not look very good, not very inspired against the Bengals. They get a chance to go in Cincinnati, where I think they will win. This is a team that's gotten better along the way. Yeah, they had a hard time at Indianapolis. I think everybody who plays at Indianapolis is going to have a hard time this year. I think the Ravens are quietly under the radar, reestablishing themselves as one of the best teams in the AFC. We're talking about the Broncos. We're talking about the Colts. We're talking about the Patriots. We're forgetting about the Ravens. And I think any good team likes it that way. So everything is looking very good right now for the Ravens, moving in the right direction, winning games despite all the controversy, and I think the winning is going to continue for the Ravens, and they're going to be there right at the end. They're going to be in the mix for the opportunity to represent the AFC in the Super Bowl. Okay, now is the last question. This one, I guess we cleared the phone lines after the experience. We had more calls on the line. I think the smart move was to dump all of them after the one that did make it through. At Rick Howard, really? Maybe we should reopen the phone lines. Who put the bop in the bop? Yeah, here's his real question. Do you think another team could lure Demaryius Thomas away? Here's what I think is going to happen in Denver. And it's no shock. It's no surprise. This isn't Pulitzer-level material. The reports that emerged yesterday that the Broncos aren't talking to Julius Thomas or Demaryius Thomas about a new contract. They haven't been talking. And there's no indication they're going to talk. The problem is Demaryius and Julius Thomas are having great enough seasons that their leverage goes up. And you have one franchise tag to use. And I think what's going to happen is that since it's cheaper to sign a tight end than it is to sign a receiver, I could see the Broncos getting Julius Thomas signed and then using the franchise tag on Demaryius Thomas if Peyton Manning is coming back for next year. If he's not, you don't need both of those guys. So I think that's the key here. Does Peyton Manning come back next year? If they win the Super Bowl and he decides that's it, I'm done, I'm walking away, I don't think he will. But if he does, then I think you invest those resources elsewhere. But if Peyton Manning's back, I don't think that another team's going to have a chance to lure Demaryius Thomas, because I think either he gets signed to a long-term deal or he gets the franchise tag applied to him. My guess is they sign Thomas Julius to the long-term deal and they apply the franchise tag to Thomas Demaryius. And that's it for Live PFT this week. I'll be back Monday from the main NBC Sports Group studios in Stamford, Connecticut. We'll be with you around the clock at ProFootballTalk.com and tune in at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time on NBCSN for a full hour to get you ready for Week 8 and also to take a look back on that game. The game was close at times, but ultimately the Broncos won handily like we kind of knew they would. See you back here again tomorrow. Have a great one.
The Bills have a chance to go into their bye week 5-3 and very much alive in the AFC East race.
We're a happy 1-6. We're an ascending 1-6. We've got a young quarterback. He's going through some rough spots. He's thrown too many interceptions, but I think the raw material is clearly there with him.
Is there any cause for hope if McCoy ends up starting on Monday night?
I don't think so. You know, I think Dylan.
2015. Do you think there'll be a team in L.A.?
I do not.
How about 2016?
Much more possible, but I think they will know in the next several months, hey, we can, 2016 is very, very doable.
To be honest, Mike, this is a little bit of a team where no one really has established themselves as a vocal leader. Jay Cutler is not, even though much has been made about this being his team.
It's a blessing. I mean, I think it's a great opportunity that, I got a chance to just hone in on one position.
I really root for the teams that I picked to win. Last week, that was just one team, the Detroit Lions, and I could not have been happier. And I am now beating you by 5 games on the season.
You know, the back end got overhauled in the offseason. Jabari Greer, Roman Harper, Malcolm Jenkins did not come back for different reasons. And I think the Saints misjudged, frankly.